The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us, broadcasting live from our studios in New York City. This is the Empowerment Hour. I can promise you we will share insights today that will allow you to make more reasoned choices in your life. I'm going to share the latest on illness and what it's doing to millions of Americans as far as creating poverty. Cell phones, something new, other than brain tumors you should be concerned about. Also, have you ever drank that green algae, blue-green algae? Well, there's something good that it does. I'll get to that. Why laughter is contagious. That's important also. And rounding out our health and nutrition, animals and doctors are telling the same thing. Avoid genetically modified foods. What can pigs tell us? You'll hear pigs telling us about genetically engineered food. Yep, that's coming up. From the environmental section of our program today, chemical lobbies, they're powerful. How powerful? At the last minute, in the Senate Health Bill 650, the 510, they were able to get the conservatives and the liberals together and say, hey, we don't want this chemical to be taken out of these baby products, so let's leave it in the baby bottles and the sippy cups. How did they do that? What kind of lobbying power do they have over the U.S. Senate? I'll talk about that. Also from the environmental section, time permitting, the 5 mining projects in the United States that we should all be opposed to. How many of them will you know about? I'll bet most people don't know of any. Get ready to blitz New York. Let people know we are against oil and the gas industry pumping more than $1 million into Albany to sway the government into permitting hydraulic fracturing in New York State. We know it's time to take action and bring that to a halt. Water or cola? Which one's better? And we're going to do a little test. Those are just some of the things we're going to be talking about today. Our guest, a little later on in our program, continuing with our scholarly series on 9/11. What kind of operation would have been required to plan and initiate the collapse of the 3 World Trade Center buildings if indeed they were detonated and caused the collapse? I asked Professor Niels Harrit, who is professor of chemistry, University of Copenhagen in Denmark, that he'll be calling us from Copenhagen, Denmark. And also I brought in another scientist to share insights on this as well, and that is Kevin Ryan. And he is he's a chemist, and he had worked as a site manager for the division of Underwriters Laboratories. He was writing to the National Institutes of Standards and Technology and speaking out about discrepancies in its World Trade Center investigation and the laboratory work to ensure the fire resistance in the buildings. What did he know that caused them to get angry with him? Why didn't we hear about this man before and his work? And how does it challenge the official position? We are saying publicly on the record and have in a series of conversations over a period of time, that the official version is simply inaccurate. We are not hypothesizing what the actual events were. We're simply, like a puzzle, we're taking one piece at a time and examining it. But as you will see, our examination is based upon scholarship and high standards to detail. Let us begin. This morning I was lecturing at a school out in Plainville, New Jersey, the Barack Obama Green Charter High School. It had a packed room. There were several schools that came together. And I spoke with 9th and 10th graders, people 15, 16 years old, and I asked them, what is it you need to know? And they were talking about illnesses and their parents, diabetes. And I asked them, how many people here, come from families where you have illness? Hands went up. Most were from low-income areas. And I asked them to work with me in helping them get healthy and then helping their parents get healthy. We're starting in about a week by introducing fresh-made organic juices in the morning. And I said, now you eat some healthy food now, but it's boring, I understand. Oh, yeah, it's boring. I said, what if we made that healthy food interesting, exciting, spicy? I said, you tell me the junk food you like, pizzas, French fries, and I'll show you how to make that healthy. And so therefore, you get the taste you like until you can wean yourself off. We're going to start with some fresh-made organic grape juice, apple juice, orange juice, and an original recipe I have for a V8 kind of juice. And then gourmet recipes to get them into eating really exciting food. But at the bottom of all this is medical bills and illness. What's wrong with that? Well, because it's plunging millions of Americans into poverty. And those who are already poor, it's making not only poor, but it's also making them so sick many times they can't even go to work, because they're too ill. So I believe we should have a national grassroots effort of support groups and work in small groups of getting people healthy over a three-month period when they see how much weight they can lose, their blood pressure comes down, cholesterol comes down. Then people start to pay attention. Well, gee whiz, I didn't realize I could lose this much weight. My blood pressure can come down. I can get off these medications in a relatively short period of time and do it as painlessly as possible. So I'm starting in two separate charter schools, one in Newark and one in Plainville, where 90% of the students are African American, 10% are Latino, and they're coming from lower income groups. So if we can show how we can get America's school kids healthy and conscious and also get their parents healthy and conscious, then I think we can take this nationwide. And it's all free. I do it as a public service. Everyone helps one another. If we don't do this, then we're right up against what the World Health Organization said today, that, quote, that more people are going to go into dire poverty and facing catastrophic medical bills. Quote, in my view, universal coverage is an admirable goal and a timely one, and we have to bite the bullet. That's according to the World Health Organization Director General Margaret Chan. I'm opposed to Dr. Chan on her views on H1N1. I believe it's a completely concocted pandemic. But on this, I agree. The number one reason people are filing for bankruptcy is medical bills. Behind that are other bills. So when we talk about health, we must also at the same time talk about cost. And there's no reason that people should be going bankrupt. First and foremost, a student asked me this morning, but isn't it expensive to eat healthy? And I said, no, it's just the opposite. And I gave him an example. How much does a pound of potato chips cost? And they were saying, oh, it's only $1.75 or $2.50. I said, no, that's for a bag, and that's only 3 ounces. How many ounces in a pound? Multiply that by the number of ounces in a pound, and then you're at $15. So if you said, I'm going to go spend $15 for a pound of potato chips. I'm going to get trans fats, salt, defried, acrylamides that can cause constipation, colorectal cancer, defect my genes, and contribute to diabetes. Or I could take an organic potato at 60 cents and bake it and put on some seasoning and have my protein, calcium, alpha-lipoic acid, good nutrients, even vitamin C. Do you realize you get almost as much vitamin C in a potato as you get in an orange? So all we have to do is dispel the myths. But the myths have been out there for a long time. Anyhow, the effort is on. Now, cell phones, we know that it can destroy chromosomes, overheat the brain, that the only amount of safe use of a cell phone is about 120 seconds. That's 2 minutes per week. New information. And again, everything I cite is from a peer-reviewed journal. This is from the American College of Allergy and Asthma and Immunology. And this was an important study, and here's what it says, quote, "The time you chat endlessly on your cell phone, better be careful. It can lead to allergic reactions." So say allergists. They also said that the form of cosmetics to jewelry, body piercing to tattoos, allergies can lurk in unlikely places. Quote, "Increased use of cell phones with unlimited usage plans has led to more prolonged exposure to the nickel in phones." That's according to Dr. Fonisser, who's a fellow of the Institute. "Patients come in with dry, itchy patches on their cheeks, jawlines, and ears, and have no idea what is causing these allergic reactions. Nickel is one of the most common contact allergens and affects an awful lot of men and women. And so nickel is what they put into the cell phone. So when you put the nickel, which is also in the nickel coin, but it's also in paper clips, but it's in the cell phone, and that's causing allergens. Now, nickel can be transferred from fingers to the face and cause eyelid irritation. And the longer you use the cell phone, the more problems you have. For those of us who drink our health drinks each day, and hopefully you're drinking your fresh vegetable juice or making a powdered juice, here's some good news for you. To show you that all that chlorophyll and phytonutrients was doing you a lot of good. This is the latest on this. Drink your blue-green algae and increase your energy and improve memory. What they have found is that the nutrients, the phytonutrients that these are grown in and become a part of, increase energy in the body and can protect the brain. And the molecule of love is also enhanced in the brain, and which increases happiness, joy, and love when you stimulate this in the brain. And it's called PEA. PEA is the nutrient, the molecule of love. So the more green juices you have, the more happiness and love and joy you should experience, because it's naturally stimulating the brain in a good way. By the way, it also contains chlorophyll, which helps purify your liver and purify your blood and gives you a lot of good nutrients. Laughter is contagious, according to the latest study from a Dr. Scott, University College of London, measured the brain activity of volunteers in a functional MRI scanner while they played them laughter, squeals of triumph, and moans of fear and disgust. She also played a neutral artificial sound that would have no specific meaning to the subjects. It was found that all the emotive sounds triggered a response in the brain's premotor cortical area, the area that controls movement and facial muscles. Inside the brain scanners, though, the subjects were not actually using these muscles. To Scott, this indicates that the brain is wired with mirror circuits that prime us to copy another's behavior when we recognize their emotions. The brain response was more pronounced for the sounds of laughter and triumph. And so therefore, it becomes almost contagious. And that's why when someone's laughing, we laugh with them. And it's a natural part of our hardwiring. This was published in the Journal of Neuroscience and done at, also equaled up at, Purdue University. And finally, doctors and animals alike tell us avoid genetically modified food, from Jeffrey Smith. The farmer grinned as he told the visitor, "Watch this." He called his pigs, which ran frantically toward him to be fed. But when he scooped out some corn and threw it on the ground, the pigs sniffed it and then looked up at him and like they were confused. The farmer then scooped corn from another bin and flung it near the pigs, which ran over and quickly devoured it. The farmer said, "The first corn is genetically engineered. They won't touch it." Well, it's not just pigs that swear off genetically modified organisms. In South Africa, the Oppenheimer chickens won't eat genetically modified corn. Most buffalo in Haryana, India, refuse cottonseed cakes made from genetically modified cotton plants. Geese migrating through Illinois only munch sections of the soy field that was non-genetically engineered. When given a choice elk, deer, raccoons, and rats all avoided genetically modified organisms, and even during the coldest days of Iowa winter, squirrels, which regularly devour natural corn, refused to touch the genetically modified variety. One skeptical farmer who read about the squirrels wanted to see for himself if it was true. He bought a bag of genetically modified corn ears and another of non-genetically modified and left them in his garage till through the winter. But by the time he fetched the bags, mice had done the experiment for him. They broke into the natural corn bag and finished. The genetically modified cobs were not touched. No one knows why the animals refused genetically modified organisms, but according to a statement by the American Academy of Environmental Medicine, when lab animals do eat genetically modified feed, it's not pretty. Quote, several animal studies indicate serious health risks associated with genetically modified foods, and specifically infertility, immune problems, accelerated aging, insulin regulation, and changes in major organs and the gastrointestinal system among the impacts of eating genetically modified organisms. There is more than a casual association between genetically modified foods and adverse health effects. There is causation. One more reason not to buy anything that is genetically modified. Remember, there's been no long-term human studies at all. And also, when we look at the actual evidence, we see that the animals, especially in India, grazing on cotton plants after harvest, sheep also grazing on them, died by the thousands. Preliminary investigations show, quote, strongly suggesting evidence the sheep death was due to a toxin, most probably BT toxin. And that is in the genetically modified, but not in your regular and organic. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. To welcome all of you from all over the world. Over half the people listening to this program are listening throughout the world over the internet. And any time you miss a program and you'd like to catch up, just go to Progressive Radio Network, go to the archives, and you can listen to any of the programs. Now, from our environmental section today, a chemical lobby gets its way in the U.S. Senate. This is from Common Dreams. For several years now, Environmental Working Group has been warning of the risk associated with biphenyl A. Now, if you've been listening to this program, you know that we do more on environmental issues than any other program in the United States. It's a daily basis. And I've told you, don't consume any product that has the chemical BPA in it. That would include baby bottles and sippy cups and cans of infant formula. Why? Because it's been shown to cause dysregulation of the immune system, it depresses the immune system, and it kills DNA. Well, thanks to the efforts of Senator Dianne Feinstein, there was briefly a deal this week after months of negotiations to include some regulation of this chemical in a food safety bill that will pass the Senate sometime in the next couple of weeks. The deal agreed to by Republicans and trade associations, including the Grocery Manufacturers Association, would ban the chemical in baby bottles for 6 months and directed by FDA to finalize its assessment on the safety bill by December, two years from now. Well, then the American Chemical Council came in at the last moment, and they lobbied, and they whispered in the politicians' ears, and the agreement was thrown out the window. Once again, unlimited amounts of money are given
to campaigns and to legislators, and they changed their vote. Democrats and Republicans both sold out. So not even our most vulnerable, the babies in America today, can have anything done on their behalf to protect them. Not if, in the process, the manufacturers are going to have to lose a bit of money or make some changes. Profits ahead of people, and we shouldn't be surprised by that. Later today on my 3 o'clock show, I'm going to go into depth on the 5 places in the United States that they're planning on doing some massive drilling and excavation, and we should not allow this. But in New York in particular, New York State Assembly has had over $1 million spent by lobbyists from the oil and gas industry trying to sway them in permitting hydraulic fracturing in New York State. And so we don't want this. We do not want these gas holes pumped and all those chemicals poured in. And none of those chemicals have been tested on human health. And so what happens is we need you to call your state legislature today and say, no fracking in New York State. We need a massive one-day call push. And so I'm suggesting that we call the state speaker, Sheldon Silver, at 518-455-3791, 518-455-3791, and say no. Now remember, the lobbyists have already been there, and they have greased the wheels, and we know that Albany is one of the most corrupt states in its legislative process in America. Politicians are regularly bought and sold. So let's say no. The people of New York State count and call Governor David Patterson, 518-474-8390, 518-474-8390, and say no to that. And the assembly person, Joseph Lindtall, who chairs the Codes Committee, 518-455-4477, 518-455-4477. So it's time that we spoke back. We don't want fracturing in New York State. We don't want all this pollution of our water. We don't want to turn on the water tap and have fire come out, and that's what happens, and whole communities' water supply permanently contaminated. Now let's go into our studio and say hello to Carol Lee, our program director. Before we go to our guests, new information today, brand new information that you have not heard of before, that we are going to put together a hypothesis. How could the towers plus building number 7 collapse if not by the airplanes? You'll get their information and documentation to support it. Hi, Carol Lee.
Hello, Gary. Well, I'll be brief because I know you've got 2 great guests on today, but I just wanted to come on and tell everyone to check out the holiday section of our website. We've got some great holiday recipes up there from a selection of our hosts on the Progressive Radio Network, and we're still adding more. Along with that, we've got some holiday pictures, and you can submit your own pictures and recipes, and it's right there on progressiveradionetwork.com/holiday.
Good. I put about, I think, 20 recipes because people are always asking me, what can I eat if I don't want to eat this standard unhealthy fare during a holiday season? So I put up some gourmet vegan recipes with photographs. And I took the photographs. They're my own original recipes. And Mia Ronstadt, an outstanding artist, a very creative and sensitive person with food, did the artwork. So you'll really appreciate it because, mind you, every single recipe looks like it came out of Gourmet magazine or Epicure magazine, but you could make them yourself. They're not difficult. I believe food should be exciting, and they're free. We do it as a public service. So just go to Progressive Radio Network, link under the recipes, and you can download them and enjoy them.
And share some of your own.
Yes.
And let people know what food you like to make for your holiday fare.
And we're putting them on my Facebook page also, and we have all kinds of interesting stuff on that Face page. So good.
Thanks so much, Gary. And as another announcement, we're also working on building some more articles about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. And so those will also be posted on Gary's Facebook, and you can check some of them out at our other site, vaccineinitiative.org. We've got some great enlightening articles and new graphs coming up. As a matter of fact, I got an email today from a man named Roman. He says that he's been working for years gathering data and historical documents on diseases and vaccines. He's got at least 74 unique and mind-blowing reports, and he says he has an extensive timeline and many quotes from historical documents, and he started to assemble them all into a book. He says he thinks it's going to be a great resource for people trying to understand the issue on how vaccines were not just the miracle they were made out of.
Is that Roman Bistrenik?
That is.
Okay, first, Roman Bistrenik is very scholarly. He's very methodical. Ask him to send over some of his charts. Now, up on our vaccine initiative page, we have some charts showing. Now, why are these charts important? Because these charts all come from the public health records over the centuries. And we can now prove, unequivocally prove, that the vaccines came at the end of a disease, not at the beginning. Therefore, they cannot take credit for ending measles or polio or anything else. And the charts actually show when we started implementing better nutrition and better sanitation. I think 95% of all vaccines were discovered when 95 to 98% of the disease was gone. Now, why is this important? Because how many times have you heard, well, look at all the great scourges throughout the centuries that were cured by vaccines, and without those vaccines, people would have died. And if you do not have this knowledge, you would have to go along with it, or at least it would be a reasonable argument. We're showing that those arguments are not valid. And we have the valid, actual, documented public health records. Truth stands tall to power. And that's why we do this.
Thanks, Gary.
What else?
We've got this one last email, and I'll try to keep it brief if I can.
That's all right. We still have 3 minutes before we have to go to our guest.
And it's talking about this man said he was watching Keith Olbermann last night, and on the show they had Michael Moore on, and one of the men who was on there talking to him is a whistleblower now, but he used to work for some of the black corporations that were trying to get rid of and ruin his reputation. The guy sent me this interesting email saying that he also used to do this as his job back in the early 1970s, as early as 1972, and he said that he used to work for the Null Problem. And after you came out with your first best-selling book, The Complete Encyclopedia of Natural Healing,
That wasn't my first book. A Complete Handbook of Nutrition was my first book. And he's saying he worked on the Null Problem.
Yes.
The
yes.
Null Problem. I didn't know I was a problem.
He says so that in the mid-1970s, they thought maybe, you'd just be this big hit and you would fade away. But by the mid-1970s, you were writing articles going after cancer and going after big pharma. And, they realized that you were going to be the major issue with health. And he says, he doesn't want to give away too many details, but he had one specific instance that he thought would really show that he was telling the truth and was giving you an actual story. He says, you had a book that you were going to publish, and one of your books had said that you needed to take 2 micrograms, and I can't remember exactly what the ingredient was, but somebody switched it to milligrams right before it was about to be published. There was this leaked story by a reporter talking about a nutritionist giving unhealthy recommendations in his book. And you were looking it up, and you realized that you had to double-check this book right before it was printed. And
oh, hold on. Let me give a little background on that. Whoever wrote this must be telling the truth, because no one knows this story. I had just finished a book, and in the book, I was giving protocols, and under one of the protocols, it was selenium, and it was 200 micrograms. And I read a story by a reporter about how some irresponsible nutritionist was advocating things that could actually harm or kill people. And I'm thinking, who was it? Whose book was out? And I thought, couldn't be mine. My book isn't out yet, and there's no advance copies, no review copies, nothing. So I called my publisher, and I said, did you send out the manuscript? No, no. Could you send me a copy of the Blues? The Blues are the actual final copy of an edited manuscript before it actually is printed. And I read through the Blues that same day, and it said 200 micrograms. I said, well, that's not me. And then I'm thinking, and I'm looking, I go into a bookstore, and I'm looking, is there any other book there? And I there were other books, but I looked, and no one had anything about 200 micrograms. And this intuitive voice in me said, it must be you. And I said, but I just saw the Blues. So the book had just been printed just the day before. So it was over New Jersey. So my brother and I went over there, and the guy thought it was weird because there were 40,000 hardback books. And I said, could I just see the book? He said, yeah. I looked at the book, and it was milligrams. Someone had changed it. Who had the power to change something? Who had the power to go from, it wasn't changed in the publishing company, it was changed at the printer. So immediately I got a rubber stamp, and my brother, Howard, sat there and stamped for 3 days, 40,000 books, micrograms, milligrams. But it showed me that I was a target, and that was how they were going to destroy my reputation. And what kind of deniability could I have? I would have been, you know, discredited, and that was it. And it was just one of those things where just knowing there were people didn't know who they were, how many they were, what they were affiliated with, but it made me extremely cautious after that. So whoever gave you that insight is the real McCoy. And the man last night, I didn't see it, but I heard about it, was from the insurance industry, and the only person from the insurance industry who was set to do a whole expose on Michael Moore and discredit him became a whistleblower. He had a pang of consciousness, and only person to come forward. And I evidently apologized to Michael Moore last night on Keith Urban. And so this guy is doing this what? Why is he doing this?
Well, he says that he recently retired, and so he has felt guilty ever since, and he just wanted to let you know that, you know, with all the work that they've been trying to do, that you still survived, and so that gives so much merit to what you're doing and the articles that you're publishing, and so he just wants to let you know to still be careful, you know, and still know that it's possible that people are still keeping track of what you're doing, but you've been doing it for so long, and they've already spent so much money trying to discredit you, you know, that you are really telling the truth and telling people what to do, and really putting up a fight, I guess, would be the best way to summarize it.
So this is someone who, since 1972 was a part of a group that was hidden out there within, I'm going to assume, the pharmaceutical industry, because that first book I wrote, The Complete Habit of Nutrition, which was the biggest selling health book in history, I took on the chemical industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the farming industry. I took on all these people. So it must have been someone from them. And so they were following me. They thought I was going to be a one-hit wonder and go away. And I stayed. All right. Well, I've assumed because of other instances that I won't talk about that there's been a group out there. And I'm sure every one of our programs are monitored. But here's the issue. Every single thing I say and write about, we can document. I've never had to retract an article, over 600 articles, anything in my books, documentaries. Now, people can agree or disagree with a different point of view, but before they disagree, let them look at all the research. Let them see a story from my eyes. Okay? If I'm working with a group of people, for example, if I was working with a group of diabetics, and over a period of 1 year, every one of those diabetics had improvements, and some were able to go from being diabetic to non-diabetic, from on insulin and medications to no insulin medications. And we had their before and after medical records, their before and after photographs, their entry and exit personal statements. Someone could say, well, it's all anecdotal. Yeah, and so is every single patient walking into every single medical doctor in the world in history. There is no such thing as a non-anecdotal patient. Everyone is anecdotal. When you walk into your doctor, what's the first thing the doctor's going to say? How are you doing? How are you feeling? How the medication's doing? And you have to give them some feedback. The doctor will then try to adjust the treatment based upon what you're giving as feedback. That doesn't mean that that is not legitimate. You get better. You know, you're going to say to the doctor, well, you didn't get me better, doctor, because it's anecdotal. Doctor says, what do you mean? You know, you were sick, now you're not. So common sense in the end will prevail. Medicine is highly political. The corporations around the medical complex are all political and economic. That does not mean that all doctors are political or economic. Many doctors are the victims of the very industry that demands they adhere to certain protocol. And to those who have the courage to stand up, the holistic doctors, good for them. But at the end of the day, what matters to me is that someone gets well. And if people are threatened by that and try to interfere in that process, so be it. But we're still standing.
Thanks, Gary.
Okay. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. We have done several programs on 9/11. And unlike other people, we do not just run in and make some statements. We try to do it very methodically and with a sense of scholarship and detail to fact. We will continue that process today. We are simply deconstructing the myth of what we were told and reconstructing what makes sense and can be proven. My guest, Professor Niels Harrit, is an associate professor in chemistry department at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. He has been there for 35-plus years. He's one of the lead scientists of the important paper, Active Thermitic Material Discovered in the Dust from the 9/11 World Trade Center Catastrophe, which was just published in the peer-reviewed journal, the Open Chemical Physics Journal. And he is well-known throughout Europe for his investigations into the causes of the collapse of the three buildings at 9/11. Also joining us is Kevin Ryan. He is a chemist who's been investigating the tragedy of 9/11 through his work at the site manager for the Division of Underwriters Laboratories. And he has a lot of information about the discrepancies behind the scenes. And we will talk with both. He has co-authored several peer-reviewed scientific articles on the subject. And he is from Journal of 911studies.com. Nice to have you both with us today.
Well, hello. This is Niels Harrit from Copenhagen. I'm happy to be on the show.
Thank you, Neil. I'm going to start with you.
Okay.
Last time you were on, I asked a basic question, but there was not time to answer. Today there is.
Yeah.
If the three buildings at 9/11 did not collapse because of the implosion of those buildings by the two airplanes and the heat, and you are proposing an alternative reason of demolitions, please go through the discussion of your hypothesis and the evidence that you can present at this time about my study. My statement was at the time, how in the world could a group of individuals get into those buildings, plant the demolitions, not be discovered in the process, not have anyone discover that the demolition material was in place, and then time that explosion to happen at the time the planes would hit the building, which meant that they would have had to have pre-knowledge of the hijacking. They would have had to have been working within the intelligence community to get that knowledge. So that's my questions. The forum is yours.
Well, actually, these were 10 questions in one sentence, close to, because I'm a scientist, and my opinion, to the best of my ability, is based on observations and experience. This is the nature of natural science. And if I might go to the start of your question, is that the evidence for controlled demolition of the three steel-framed high-rises on the southern Manhattan is overwhelming. I consider it, and thousands of other people, to be a scientific fact that the Twin Towers and Building 7 were demolished by means of explosives and other demolition devices. There's no doubt about that. So the next part of your question is quite natural. How can anyone get access to the buildings and place all these explosives? And this must be tons. I must stress on this point that I'm a chemist. I'm not a demolition expert. But I can make a fair judgment of the energetics involved in demolishing buildings of this size, and it calls for explosives and incendiaries in the amount of tons. And obviously, how can anyone get into these buildings? Well, no one can answer that question before we have a criminal investigation of the crime. And these questions should be answered in court. And my colleague and friend Kevin Ryan, who's waiting on another phone, is actually
I'll have him address that, but let's go back to the basics.
Yeah, okay.
Give the scientific evidence that you have been able to determine, along with other scientists, that a thermite explosive material and the nanotubules were discovered in the lung tissue of the first responders to the building's collapse, and what those thermitic materials will do, how explosive are they, what kind of power can they unleash to bring down those buildings?
Well, you're bringing in quite actually a very new finding, not by us but some physiologists who have examined the lung tissue of the first responders and found a nanomaterial in there called nanotubes. These are not a priori related to the red-grade chips that we found, and so maybe I should stick to them and make a little summary of our findings.
Yes, please give us your summary.
And so we are dealing some particles, we found some particles in the dust, which can be described as tiny chips. They're less than 1 millimeter, and you can just recognize them with the naked eye, because one side of it is red and the other side is gray, and the little red spots, you can eventually see the biggest one of them. But otherwise, you need a microscope to see them. And if you get that, you will see that these chips, they're red on one side, red on the other side. And these are, though we have characterized them by advanced scientific methods, the most important finding of all these data and evidence are that some of them are still reactive. Meaning that when you heat them up to 430 degrees centigrade, I don't know how many Fahrenheit that is, they take off, they react, and you can observe the reaction and the products of the chemical reaction, and one product is elemental iron. And this is an unambitious fingerprint of the reaction is thermitic. And that word probably requires a little explanation, because it refers to a highly energetic reaction, which in this case occurs between aluminum and iron oxide, which is just the academic word for rust. Very, very, very tiny particles, which have been processed by nanotechnology into this material in order for them to react very efficiently and fast. And the iron produced in this process comes out at a temperature which is far, far beyond the temperature of steel, the melting point of steel and iron, which means that this material can be used for destroying and melting steel structures. But because of the means of manufacturing, the energy of this reaction can also be converted into an explosive. And so from simple observations and the collapse of the towers and Building 7, I personally conclude, and many other scientists with me, that both the process of demolition could be the following, that in the minutes before collapses, steel structure was destroyed by means of thermite. That is, they're melting a great part of the supporting steel structure. And at the moment of initiation of collapse, you have to use explosives to have the buildings coming down the way we observed, because the charges had to be fired very accurately by some central timing, center somehow. And this probably was done in wireless means of communication. So the scenario is that the main part of the steel structure was taken away by melting, and then the explosives come in. Now we know the incendiaries used for melting the steel structure must have been thermitic. Now, as to the nature of the explosives, they could have been thermitic, because we know that that military research these years goes in this direction. Modern explosives are based on these principles. But we do not know exactly where the retrograde chips we found fit into this whole scheme. If this had been a TV interview and I was left with 15 seconds and had to answer your question in a one-liner, I would call the retrograde chips as remnant explosives. But as I've tried to explain, the story is a little more detailed and maybe more difficult also to comprehend. But the bottom line is that the retrograde chips should not have been there in the dust, and they're indicative of a controlled demolition.
Okay. Please hold your thoughts. Let's say hello to Kevin Ryan. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for inviting me.
Kevin, you're on the board of directors of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Tell us about what you think happened and what at least you have some proof to support your hypothesis.
Yes, absolutely. I began questioning the official reports and actually was a leading critic of those reports for years, and then evolved into, like Niels, like Professor Herod, I evolved into someone who believed that, and still do, believes that the buildings were demolished. And all of the physical evidence that we've seen, as well as the eyewitness testimonies that we are aware of and the photographic evidence, points to the fact that these three buildings were all demolished on September 11th. So the physical evidence includes what Professor Herrett just described, the latest paper, Active Thermitic Material, and also several other peer-reviewed scientific papers. One of them was one that I helped author called Environmental Anomalies at the World Trade Center, Evidence for Energetic Materials. And this was published in a Springer journal called The Environmentalist. And the air emissions and aerosol emissions tested by EPA and the University of California indicate that these thermitic materials were present at Ground Zero. There was a previous paper in the Open Journal of Civil Engineering called 14 Points of Agreement with Official Government Reports, and that spelled out where independent investigators like myself agree with official reports, and yet simultaneously highlights what the problems were with that agreement. For example, NIST agrees that one of the buildings fell in free fall. And that's, of course, not possible without removing all of the resistance of the structure below. So that 14 points of agreement paper is a great one to examine for kind of the initial starting point. We also published a paper called Extremely High Temperatures During the World Trade Center Destruction, which examined these iron microspheres that Professor Herrett described. They're scattered throughout the World Trade Center dust, and I can testify to that. I've received half a dozen World Trade Center dust samples myself from independent collectors and have found not only all of these iron microspheres, but also the red-gray chips that we wrote our latest paper on. These iron microspheres are evidence for a thermitic reaction, because the microspheres would have had to have been formed from molten iron at some point during the destruction of the buildings, and they don't occur in normal office dust. So there's a lot of evidence for the demolition of the buildings, and there are now quite a few peer-reviewed scientific papers that back that up.
Okay, but let's just assume for a moment that a lot of scientists agree that controlled explosive thermitic device occurred. We have hundreds of eyewitnesses who say they heard explosions, including police officers and firefighters and reporters at Ground Zero. I was at Ground Zero. And we heard, you know, that people heard these explosions prior to the building collapsing. Now, then the question is, who would have been able to get access? They would have had to have gone in there over a period of time. They would have had to have had access to the inner core structures of the building. Who would have had the ability to do that and the means to have done that? And then someone would have had to have had knowledge that this hijacking was going to occur and that the buildings were going to be the target. And then the approximate time of that target, the time detonating the explosives once those planes hit. That takes a lot of organization. These group of hijackers, these group of people could not have done that. They had neither the knowledge, the technology to do that. Your thoughts, please. I realize I'm asking you to hypothesize, but we are differentiating hypothesis speculation from the actual science.
Yeah, those are good questions and exactly the kind of questions I began asking myself about a year and a half ago. And I ended up writing a series of articles that have been published. And these aren't scientific articles, but as you said, they are hypotheses. They ask questions. And the question is, who had access to the buildings? Of those people who had access to the buildings, who had access to the technologies that we're talking about? So, for example, the nanothermite material is a kind of material that, for example, the national laboratories at the Department of Energy were developing in the 1990s. So if there are any connections to those kinds of organizations, then that would be additional answer to the question. And then finally, who of all those people benefited from the crimes of 9/11? So these papers, they go under a title of Demolition Access to the World Trade Center Buildings. There's four of them, and the first one looks at the tenants, and we see that there are some very interesting answers, and we'll get groups of answers is what happens. So we're not accusing specifically anyone when we look at this, but we do have to get these answers and try to examine where these things kind of interconnect. One of the tenants was a financial company called Marsh & McLennan that in the North Tower happened to occupy all eight of the floors where the plane impacted. And the fires occurred, and these were floors 93 to 100 in the North Tower. Those happened to be the exact eight floors out of 110 that were upgraded for fireproofing in the few years before 9/11. And this information is readily available in the government reports. So Marsh & McLennan upgraded and had control over upgrades of the fireproofing throughout these acre-wide floors in these eight floors out of 110. So the probability that the plane would impact just those eight floors is fairly low. But when we look at Marsh & McLennan, we see a lot of strange characters, one of them being L. Paul Bremer. L. Paul Bremer, shortly after 9/11 became, I guess a year and a half after, became the Iraq occupation governor. But on 9/11, he was the director of Marsh Crisis, which is a division of Marsh. And he actually had an office in the South Tower, and he survived that day. And Bremer went on television, did quite a few television interviews in which he blamed Osama bin Laden for the attacks, almost as if he was ready for the story. And he was also the director of a company, a Japanese company called Komatsu, that had patented a thermite demolition device. Now, there are very few of these kinds of devices, but in 1996, Komatsu patented a thermite demolition device, and Paul Bremer was a director of that company as well as a director of Marsh. And so we just look at these kinds of things. Obviously, Bremer had access to the buildings. He benefited in that. He became part of the group that took over Iraq and benefited from the destruction of Iraq. And he also had access to thermite demolition devices.
Okay, but again, let's keep in mind this is merely speculation. This is hypothesis, not hard proof.
That's right.
But what I want to do is this. I see that you're on a roll here, and we're running out of time. Kevin, I'm going to invite you back at my 3 o'clock show, if you can make it. I want to hear about those other theories that you have about who had access, who had the technology to detonate these, who was likely to have benefited, and who could have gotten away with it. Okay, and also one other thing, why isn't anyone talking about who profited from all of the unusual trading on Wall Street, specifically in the airlines, by putting in shorts on those airlines in larger than ever numbers? I want to talk about those too, okay? I'm Gary Knoll, Kevin Ryan, my guest, Professor Niels Herrett, my guest. We're out of time, but we will continue at the 3 o'clock show when the show is about the drugging of our children. So we'll do our drugging of our children segment, our health and nutrition segment, and continue with part two of this. We try to bring you insights into the important issues that otherwise would not get attention. Have a nice day, everyone.
In our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.